CliffCentral.com.
All right, everybody. Good morning. Lockdown day 53. That's Bongo Muffin. And Ulrich sent me a message to say, thanks for playing the White Wedding song. Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. although I love that song, and I think before it started being played at white weddings, it was very cool. What's the name of this amazing song? It's Tatiskubu. Let you know. Morning, guys. Talking about partners, I've decided to quarantine, to have two quarantine partners as lockdown started, and it worked out well. One had to go back to work, though, and still comes by for some dick. How's that, huh? That's from Yonder this morning. Do you like that, everybody? Do you like what I'm laying down here?
I have too many questions.
Way, way too many. It's like that story. Did you see that story with that girl from Ekuruleni, Malaika? And the guy, what was his name? Not Bule. Oh, anyway, I've forgotten what his name was. And the kind of like rubbish they got up to in 3 weeks of lockdown.
Oh, really?
And then he went apeshit when she broke up with him.
Oh, yeah?
And she's now been suspended at work because of bringing the office of the mayor into disrepute.
Mm.
And I'm just like, these people, Tina Sifelina in the lockdown. So, yeah, the banking with each other, coming over for like 3 days of salacious activity, the Netflix and chilling, the checking out of people, and then she got a new boyfriend. I'm like, how this girl? She got two new boyfriends during the lockdown.
No, that's amazing.
We're sitting here.
What the hell?
We're sitting here like, are you even flirting with people behind masks?
That is actually a downright talent.
Absolutely. She definitely has what it's got. She's had two boyfriends during this lockdown, from level 5 to level 4.
So then with Yonder, I want to know.
She's busy. Sure.
Come to be? Do you sit your one partner down and say, hey, how about we get someone else in? Or is it actually, yeah, too many questions?
Well, I mean,
essential workers with permits to drive around?
Yeah, Yonder's got a plan, people. Don't take it away.
Hey, it's working for Yonder, so who are we?
I mean, here's another message. This one's from Anushka. She says, I could be locked down another 2 months. I never got to enjoy my house the way I am now. She says her sex life is on point. 13 years of marriage, and it was a lockdown that made us have sex on the balcony. Lockdown on.
Anushka got it going on.
And then a message from Dudley, who says, good day, guys. I'm drinking my lemongrass and ginger tea at precisely 95 degrees. That's very important information to share. So, yeah, Dudley, you see, Dudley listened to our discussion about tea yesterday, and he took it very seriously because we were trying to explain that, you know, Leanne and I are tea Nazis. So we want our tea at a specific temperature, and you have to let the bag stay in there for so much time, and you only add the milk and sugar afterwards, and it's a whole thing. So, Dudley, I'm with you, dude. Thank you very much.
So do you, like, have a thermometer?
No, but what you do is you just leave the kettle after it's boiled fully. You leave it for a minute or a minute and a half, and then you pour your water in. Brings it down to about 95. Yeah, oh, yeah, it's a whole scientific experiment, Pums.
Evidently, jeez.
So here's something interesting. Sia, a lot of people are trying to get the picture either into or out of their heads of you prancing around pretending to be running so you can see that guy who you've seen. but some people are asking, do you run with a mask? You have to, right?
So it's been said nowadays, yes.
So, I mean, isn't that... So here's the question, and I kind of have the same question in mind. Hannes, he wants to know, when you run with a mask, is it like being waterboarded?
Yeah.
Good point, right?
See, what I've personally been doing and seeing others do this as well is you run with the mask on, but just off your mouth and nose. So it's just hanging.
Uh-huh.
And if you find someone who's running on the same side of the street as you, because, you know, often in most cases that I've encountered, once you see someone coming up towards you, either one of you will flip to the other side of the road, will cross the street so that you really are far away from each other. But if you find yourself on the same side of the street, you just pull your mask up, you run past each other, then you put it down again.
To be boring about it, so I've got an altitude mask. You can't run with a mask. What it tells you is you're not fit enough.
Just to let you know. Right. So you're running with a mask. Okay.
No, I don't have it here, but I do have it. So elite sportsmen and certain people, when they're looking to up their training, because obviously when you train at high altitude, obviously the gains are exponential. Versus training at sea level. So there's actually altitude masks that elite athletes use, and I happen to have one.
Apparently, according to Graham, you shouldn't run with a mask because it increases the chance of bacterial infection in your lungs.
Oh, you see now? I don't know anymore.
I don't know either. I'm just glad I don't run. I'm so glad.
But Mbulelo, you shouldn't be running. That's what you shouldn't be doing.
Mm-hmm. Mbulelo, thanks for that compliment, though. But no, I'm not an athlete, nor am I certain people.
Oh, you're probably not running either, Sia.
Well, John T has even more advice. John T says, exercising with a mask can cause hypoxia, breathing in too much carbon monoxide.
Oh, of course, Sam.
Who knows? I don't run, so you guys fight it out among yourselves.
You know what? Maybe that'll be an icebreaker with my Stephen Pinar light today.
Yes, yeah, you must go out there.
Should we run with masks on or not?
Have a whole debate about it. Stay out there until 9:30.
Yes.
Yeah, okay,
some serious talk though. That's not the bonding experience I want.
Get arrested together, and then, they say when soldiers go to war together, they really have this bond that they have. So you guys could have kind of write your own little Mein Kampf or whatever you get going.
What?
Could be cool.
I am not Hitler. You know what? Never mind. Okay, can we talk about some serious news?
Yes, let's get into some news before we get to Jean-Jacques. What have you got, Sia?
Okay, well, it's been the longest tease of note, but yesterday Lesotho's Prime Minister Thomas Tabane officially announced that he's stepping down.
Oh.
This ends months of this political uncertainty that's happening in the country, and still, even in his official statement announcing that he's stepping down, he didn't talk about being rolled up in the murder of his ex-wife. His statement just said, "I decided to personally come and inform you that I'm stepping down as Prime Minister of Lesotho." He continued to say, "It is rather difficult to part ways with something that you had been accustomed to and leave people behind, but we all have to leave at some point." As he announced this yesterday, he's 80 years old, and this comes, of course, as more and more details surface around the murder of his first wife, mm-hmm. just 2 days before his 2017 inauguration. Most recently, police have found his mobile number in communication records from the crime scene of his first wife's murder. So,
and as his second wife becomes more and more of a social media superstar.
Oh, goodness. She should learn to keep quiet at this point.
Yeah,
what did you see of her?
Well, how long did it take this guy to step down, this Tom Tabane? I mean, it's been ridiculous. And you know, you need a murder allegation for you to get out of office in Lesotho.
And not just, you know, like something you can justify as a political murder.
Yeah, that's true. I want to ask JJ Cornish about him, actually, because, you know, JJ reports on Africa to the rest of the world. And here within South Africa, he's one of the most clued up people when it comes to figuring out what's going on in, you know, the countries great and small on this continent of ours. So we may have to ask him. But we are joined by JJ Cornish, who's not only a journalist of great repute, but a man who works for so many news agencies, I've lost track. I mean, he writes for Agence France-Presse. He writes for a number of publications here in South Africa. The BBC uses him a lot of the time. He does reports on radio and television. So we're very privileged and delighted to have JJ Cornish with us this morning. We'll talk in a minute, JJ, about the agenda, which is how much better women are at running a crisis in a country through COVID than men are. And there's evidence to back this up. But before we get to that, first of all, how are you? And second of all, what do you take out of this Lesotho situation?
Well, to answer your first question, Gareth, good morning to you. Bonjour. I am immensely well. Any better, I would have to inform the authorities. You know, no middle-aged Mlungu deserves to be as well as I am. For Lesotho, you know, Lesotho has been, is entirely surrounded by South Africa and has often been in an enormous mess and created the biggest problems for itself. Now, here we have Tom Tabani, who's a man who's had, at best described, a checkered career as premier. He's been ousted and brought back, and the region has had to back him up enormously. And now we hear that his second wife was involved in killing his first, and that there might be some collusion.
Right.
The point is, though, and this is something that is more or less regional, certainly continental. When a whiff of scandal comes, then you step down. That is how it works. You step down. And if you then cleared, you can come back. You know, that dog in the background is the only one allowed on the London Underground, eh?
Are you serious? A Cavalier King Charles Spaniel?
King Charles Spaniel is the only one allowed on the London Underground. Yeah, unless it's a guide dog, of course.
You mean Carl could go with me on the Underground and no other dogs?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Carl is superior.
I will give you many of them today, Gareth.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Look at you. Surprising me about this. Why are they so special?
Well, because King Charles Spaniel, you know, they of royal lineage, and they were bred by King Charles and so on.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
So you've not only informed us about what's going on with Tom Tabani, but you've also helped me figure out that if I ever go to London, my dog can accompany me on all public transport. Now let's turn to something of even more startling significance, because we're sitting in a world where governments...
Startling!
I mean... No, not startling because because of the gender of the people in discussion, but we're dealing with a world where governments have made horrible decisions, and decisions that will impoverish people for a generation, decisions that will send swathes of the population into unemployment. Many people have also been taken out by this hideous disease. But we discussed our response to COVID-19 on the Burning Platform when we last had you here, and you said to me the other day, hey, wouldn't you like to compare the women leaders of the world and the men, and let's see who made the better calls? So what have you got for us on that front?
Well, there's no doubt that the women have made the better calls. There have been some few token good men, but the fact is,
okay,
here we have, there are two elements in dealing with COVID-19.
All right.
That are going to cause us to look again at the way we run the world. One is the economy. I mean, the environment, excuse me. Certainly the economy, we're going to look, you say, a generation. I certainly hope we fix it in a generation. But the environment, we have dirtied our planet, and suddenly not using it to the extent that we have, we see a remarkably clean and unsullied planet. Now, are we going to learn lessons from that and allow this to continue? The second is that we have sold women short classically through the ages, and suddenly it is the women who are coming up as the better leaders in the worst crisis in modern history, and they are coming up trumps in doing that. And are we going to, is this going to be the turning point where suddenly we don't recognize women for being what other directed and emotionally mature and those sort of things, but we recognize them for their resilience? Well, Theresa May would have probably pointed us to that before the COVID-19 pandemic, but for their pragmatism, for their benevolence, and for their simple common sense. You know, Gareth, there are three elements, I think, in dealing with COVID-19.
All right.
Three elements that have contributed to its rise: population density.
Yes.
Exposure to the outside world, travelers, etc.
Right.
And thirdly, the speed with which governments reacted, i.e. closing down their countries to prevent COVID-19 coming in and spreading.
Okay.
Now, the first two, you can't really attribute to leaders. But the third, that sort of leadership is right down to leaders. And when you get what, you know, the many weeks that Donald Trump and that Boris Johnson, I nearly called him Bojo the Bog Roll Bandit, as the son liked to do, because, you know, he...
Because why? What did he do? What did he do with Bog Roll?
Well, he had cartons of toilet roll sent round to number 10. when we still believed that was the one thing we were going to run out of. And I think it was the Sun, but one of the tabloids had as its headline the unforgettable Bojo, that's what they call Boris Johnson, Bojo the Bog Roll Bandit.
I love that. All right, but you said that the first two we can't do much about, but I do recall Donald Trump putting a ban on China flights right in the end of January already. I mean,
some of them. It was a token thing. He did not close off. I mean, Chinese were still allowed to come to America.
Wasn't that?
No. It certainly wasn't a ban.
Wasn't that repatriation of Americans to America?
No, he brought some Americans back, but he did not close China down as he claims to.
Okay. All right.
There were many, many Chinese coming through. Now, of course, with his election in mind, he's saying all kinds of things. And in fact, he's blaming everybody in sight, Barack Obama for taking the stocks of medication, the World Health Organization. And we're going to talk about that later, possibly. But the World Health Organization saying cost many lives. In fact, Donald Trump's reticence and belief in that it was simply the flu and his inability to act quickly is the thing that has cost many lives in America and got those huge figures of deaths and cases.
It's not Andrew Cuomo sending old people back into retirement homes after they'd been tested positive.
Well, I mean, there are many, many contributing factors, but certainly Donald Trump has, what do you say in COVID's case? You don't say blood on your hands. You probably say,
well, I don't want to talk about him. Tell us about these women.
Here we go. Now, let's talk about the leaders. The ones that come to mind immediately as the strongest. Angela Merkel of Germany. Mm-hmm. Jacinda Ardern of New Zealand.
Yes.
Jana Marin of Finland. Erna Solberg of Norway.
Uh-huh.
Katarina Jakobsdottir of Iceland. And Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan.
All right.
Those are actual leaders. I also bring in Nicola Sturgeon, the first Minister of Scotland, who stood up to Bojo. And, you know, they have, what is in every case, they have acted quickly, acted decisively. And this is because they have dealt with the common good. It seems to be that women have a greater, you know, as I say, we disparage the women leadership in the past, talking about their other direction and their emotional maturity and that sort of thing. But they have shown that they have what is really counts as leadership, vision, inspiration. They're all of them inspirational leaders. The direction setting, what should we do next? And the ability to think outside of the box. They've all displayed this enormously. As I say, some men have also.
Yeah.
But in virtually every case, 7% of the world's leaders are women. And this list I've given you here is probably makes up a good percentage of that, you know, probably more than half of them. So you know, they take advice. They are more community-spirited. Men regard themselves as, you know, up for re-election, and that is what they've got to look for. Keep their eye on the main chance. The women seem to look to leadership. Now it's a fact that 80% of American men, certainly, when asked about the leader they admire most, man, And 75% of men think that they are smarter than the average. That figure is only 57% when it comes to women. So they don't have this hubris. They don't have this, well, what is the word? Arrogance. Mm. And so I believe very strongly that they have shown themselves to be the predominant leaders, the better leaders in this crisis, the worst crisis that we've experienced in our lifetime. And that hopefully this will be the turning point, that we will look again at women leaders and regard them simply as leaders and hopefully as good leaders.
Now, I know Pumi's thinking that I put you on this morning especially to sing praises of women. But honestly, Pumi, this is news to me. I didn't know some of these leaders' names until this morning. What do you think of this?
Look at the other thing that they have all done exceptionally well. And Jacques, I don't know what you think about this, but they're also very communicative. So when they talk to their constituents, when they talk to their countries, they're serious about it. And they have empathy and they know how to, unlike what we've had, where we've had this authority kind of top down, is they've been very much a, guys, we're all in this together. We have to do something about it. This is serious. I mean, the quote, I think, from New Zealand was, this is serious. Take it seriously. She took it seriously and the rest of the country took it seriously as well. So that's the other thing that they do very well. I mean,
think as a result, they're emerging from lockdown way ahead of everybody else. Certainly, they've managed to keep their infection and death rate very, very low. And maybe that's just because New Zealand is so small and so isolated anyway, but she certainly stepped up. I mean, I don't like her accent, but I can only admire the way that she's run things.
What have you got against open vowels? I just don't understand. You know, I was very careful not to interrupt to you because then she would have said, ah, typical male, you're not even listening to me talking about women listening. But, you know, she's so absolutely right. Women are inclined, and women leaders are inclined to consult far, far more widely than men who work on their hunches and their gut feelings. And yeah, this is what I feel, and you know, this is what I believe should be happening. And men don't have, and my favorite expression, as you will have learned last time, is I don't know. Now, women are more inclined to say I'm not sure.
Yeah.
And ask people and look around and consult more widely. Men, particularly men politicians, have an absolute pathological inability to say, I don't know. Let me ask.
But I have one name for you that's going to ruin your theory. Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma.
Well, I'm not saying that she... I go back a long way with Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma. From the days when she was foreign secretary. I remember coming out of press conferences, she used to put her hand on my forearm and say, come here, and want to talk to me about a few things and fulminate and carry on making the point she was making. I used to have to say, Minister, I've actually come to your press conference to cover it. I've got to go and write copy now. Please, can we talk another time?
Oh, so she's a chatterbox, sir. She likes to
She just wants people to understand that there's more to her, I think, and there certainly is. I mean, you know, you make a big mistake sort of dismissing Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma as the former wife of President Jacob Zuma.
Yeah.
She is a significant woman. She is, and other women like to call her a warrior. I cannot but agree with her. She is a fighter. She is formidable, but she does have a very sharp, not to say spiteful side to her. And did you see what happened to the journalists? You remember that Canton and I said, well, her her standing firm on the issue of cigarettes made President Cyril Ramaphosa look a bit silly. Within a few days, he'd come up and say, no, that was a joint decision. I was there. Did you see the journalists on ENCA who criticized her and said that she had made a power play against
Cyril Ramaphosa? They had to be suspended and make an apology.
All journalists make every apology made by a journalist is a groveling apology.
Yeah, always.
No, but I think that the thing with it's a misnomer to think that Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma is the person that on her own has all of the sway. I mean, I know people who are in that room with the council.
National Coronavirus Command Council.
But and fascinatingly for me is that the word coming out of there is that the person who is right at the top there is the health ministry. So Zweli Mkhize is the person with the largest share of voice. Zweli and his advisors have the largest share of voice, followed by, surprise, surprise, Begicele, and whether they can enforce any of the rules and all of the crazy things and regulations that are coming out, that the council, that the health council are feeling they are trumping everything. And I think, look, you know, it is for all of us on the outside, it's easier to just blame another.
Yeah, I know. And I was half being sarcastic when I brought her into it, because there are as many bad women as there are bad men in the world. But there seems to be, and I don't disagree with any of the things that either you or Jean-Jacques have said, Pumi, about how women are more consultative, more community-oriented, more empathetic. I get all of that, and I'm absolutely on board with it. In fact, I think it's probably what has made the world a lot more peaceful in the last 100 years, as opposed to the previous couple of thousand, where it was only men in charge and it was usually a disaster. You know?
I'm worried about, I hope that Pumi wasn't slagging off Begicele. You know, he is, in fact, people say that he should have been put in charge of a country, a more authoritarian country, and that he's strongly anti-booze. I can exclusively reveal that he's easing up on the alcohol ban.
How
and,
so?
And he's making concessions that from today we are going to be able to buy ice.
All right. Now, JJ, what are the other countries in Africa up to at the moment? Do we have any updates from the last time we spoke to you about how Zimbabwe, Zambia, our immediate neighbors, Mozambique, Namibia, Botswana, are dealing with COVID? Whether anybody is dealing with it better than we are?
I don't think dealing with it better. Did you see the Zimbabwe media literally coming apart? They're going to probably not be left with any newspapers at the end of it. And that's a very sad thing. But, you know, I know that I traveled with... when we did the obligatory tour of United States with journalists from all over the world, I had a Zimbabwean with me. And when we spoke about problems in the media, you know, we spoke about sort of ideological and political problems. His always was newsprint. It was purely, coldly financial. And now that nobody is buying newspapers in Zimbabwe, I think those newspapers are going to fold. And that would be very, very sad, because Zimbabwe, in terms of political space being closing up still under the new president, it's in dire straits. So it needs its media, and that's going to be very sad. I see that in Mozambique, up north, Cabo Delgado, they're still having problems with the jihadis, and that the Tanzanians have moved troops onto the border. But in terms of what is happening in fighting COVID-19, I don't think they're doing a terrible job. Botswana is battling on, as is Namibia. So in the neighborhood, we are, and Lesotho, of course, has very few. Lesotho only recently had its first case. Huh. So we're not doing too badly. When we do open up, of it coming in from immediate neighbors is not something that should be front of mind.
Okay.
But a little bit further up north, JJ, they're not dealing with it very well, because there's a lot of denials coming out of the rest of the continent a little further up north, kind of, and suppression of data. So the numbers aren't being reported as well as we're reporting our numbers. I think it's a little bit of a, but that's African leaders and a well-established way of dealing with things with some of our older leaders on the continent is not.
I did a piece this week, Pumi, or last week, in fact, on the remedy, herbal remedy that Madagascar is selling, and got furious that the World Health Organization gave it the thumbs down, saying if this had been a European remedy, it would have been seized upon. The fact is, though, that Tanzania, which has a president, John Magufuli, who has a chemistry degree, sent a plane to pick up a plane load of this remedy.
Yes, from
Equatorial Guinea. Kenya, Nigeria, Niger, all picked up on this herbal remedy.
John Magufuli was also the one who made them bring in the tests, and then he thought these tests were a bit suspicious, so he let them test some of it on pawpaws and goats and gave them human names. And they came back positive, and he said, hey, guys, you're pulling the wool over our eyes. Please don't send us rubbish tests like this.
He fired his chief scientist as a result of that.
That's right.
But John Magufuli, again, where as Pumi says, plays with figures, you know, and then he tells churches to open, and then he vacillates. John Magufuli, a populist and authoritarian, you know, I wish he was more like Ben Mpaka, who the previous president, who this...
Sorry, JJ, we lost you there for a second.
Coronavirus.
You were saying the former president, and then you cut out, sorry.
Benjamin Mpaka saying, we will rise from this. But we've got to do it right. And he is talking about nature. He says the degree of this pandemic is very largely attributable to us to ignoring the realities of nature, that this is the source of our food, the source of our energy, the source of our water, and we've got to look after nature. And this point I was making earlier, hopefully we will have a cleaner planet at the end of it.
Well, the thing we have spoken on this show, and it's one of my favorite cures for the flu over winter, we've spoken about the cure coming out of Madagascar, and I can send you some, Gareth. We've spoken about it, Umhlonyane, right?
Have you got some?
Well, I get it from Kanako's grandmother's garden, right? Because it grows like a weed. Okay. This is the African wormwood. Remember, we spoke about it all those many months ago.
Okay, all right. You're going to be my, you're my sangoma.
So this is also a kind of at about 95 degrees. It's like tea. You drink it like tea, and you can put honey in it. It tastes bitter as hell. But it works for chest infections. So it works for the flu. It works for colds when you have it. And as you know, Kanako's got asthma, and this is our standard kind of one tot a day for the winter months. So I will be taking that as well. I'll send you some if you want.
Well, JJ, it sounds like we should send you a consignment as well.
Well, I'm vegetarian, so I can't take the chicken soup from, from the Jewish grandmother. But maybe this does has apparently had beneficial effects for those suffering from malaria. But, you know, Gareth, the very first lesson you learn as a journalist is don't talk about miracle cures. They don't exist.
Yeah.
And that is why, as responsible journalists, we don't talk about cures for cancer.
Yeah.
Although if you look at social media, you get a new one every 3 minutes.
And the fact is
be
also,
very careful talking about cures.
Like even all this hype about a vaccine, we know that even if they develop a vaccine, and by the way, they've never developed a vaccine for SARS and MERS, which are most closely related to this coronavirus. They've never developed those properly. And we know that the flu vaccine only works half the time. So we've got to deal with this. We've got to live with this.
There was some good news about vaccine. Moderna, the company, reckons that they could have it out by January. Everybody is racing. This is now we're getting to the World Health Organization assembly. And yesterday, Cyril Ramaphosa, our president, was saying that we South Africans are working on that vaccine, and what eventuates has to be for everybody. This is something, it's a global thing, and we've got to look at it together. We've got to work in solidarity, but we very proudly are part of the efforts to this vaccine. I mean, we have, again, further afield, not a million miles removed from Washington, people saying that, you know, they're putting up a vaccine and they're going to buy all the stocks they can. They literally want to buy the vaccine and vaccinate the American people first. Now that sort of thing is absolutely anathema in terms of the World Health Organization. We need to do it. We had apparently scientists, you remember 3 weeks ago, well, two last month, we had those idiot French doctors talking about testing the vaccine on poor Africans who have not had preventative measures to COVID-19 in the same way as we should test HIV vaccines on prostitutes who are not properly protected. The doctors had the good sense to apologize and to pull their necks in after that. But we do have now scientists saying, yes, when we and with the outcry simply said, Africans are not going to be the guinea pigs, are not going to be guinea pigs for testing the vaccine. But now scientists are saying, but of course, when we have proper tests, proper clinical tests, we do have to have Africans in that, because we have to know that the vaccine is going to be efficacious for the entire world, not just for parts of it.
Yeah. Now, that makes a lot of sense, but I think we're putting far too much stock in the idea of a vaccine, like it's going to be a cure. And I think this disease will be around for many years, and we will have to learn to live with it.
Well, indeed we will, and more medical experts are saying that, you know, that we're going to have to, well, and we are going to have to, but the point is, if you can vaccinate.
Yeah.
The effects and the ability this disease will have to overwhelm our medical services.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I'm afraid I'm going to have to draw our little party to a close this morning, because we have to get to Blind History. And Jean-Jacques, it is such a pleasure to speak to you. Pumi, as always, we love having you on a Tuesday morning. It's a highlight of my week. And guys, have an excellent Tuesday today. I hope you get lots done. And Jean-Jacques will no doubt check in with you again soon. Pums and Sia and Mbulelo, we will be back next Tuesday. And coming up, an episode on Genghis Khan. Now, this guy had a short but expansive reign. He brought millions of souls under the banner of the Mongol Empire. They rode and they fought on horseback. He and his horde advanced into Persia, Eastern Europe, and China with such ferocity that even long after his reign had ended, the mere mention of the name Genghis Khan would make men shudder, women weep, and children hide. Such.
You've got to say, Gareth, he got a rotten press, eh?
Well, listen, they say that one in five men in the world is a direct descendant in the male line of Genghis Khan. So he also infused the whole of the human genome with his influence. It wasn't enough that he took over by brute force. And what a guy. I mean, after studying him before we put this episode together, I now have such an interest and a curiosity and a respect for those Mongolians who managed to almost take over the whole of the then known world, and such an incredible time in human history. So if you want to find out about Genghis Khan, you're in luck, because Blind History Season 3, Episode 10 is next. It is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters, and my co-host for the series is Anthony Medera, who you must know by now. If you haven't listened to all the episodes before, get them from cliffcentral.com. And by the way, while we're on that, we had a very popular episode of an interview which I conducted with Reg Lascaris just the other day about marketing and media and how you should be thinking about your brand during COVID-19. If you haven't heard that yet, get on to cliffcentral.com. We have a YouTube video if you prefer to see what's going on, but you can also listen in to the podcast, as many thousands of people already have. Plus, a whole bunch more. Just go and explore on cliffcentral.com. Here's Blind History, Season 3, Episode 10, Genghis Khan. During his short but expansive reign, he brought millions of souls under the banner of the Mongol Empire. Riding and fighting on horseback, he and his horde advanced into Persia, Eastern Europe, and China with such ferocity that even long after his reign had ended, the mere mention of his name would make men shudder, women weep, and children hide. Such was the reputation of the great Genghis Khan. His real name was Temujin Borjigin, but he was officially Genghis Khan, or the Genghis Emperor, founder and first emperor of the Mongol Empire, which became the largest contiguous empire in history after his death. Now, he came to power by uniting many of the nomadic tribes of the northeast in Asia. After founding the empire, he also launched Mongol invasions that conquered most of Eurasia. Campaigns initiated in his lifetime included those against many different tribes, even the Shah of Iran, and raids into medieval Georgia all the way in Eastern Europe. These campaigns are accompanied by
in historical records, massive massacres of civilian populations. So we'll talk about those when we get into the nitty-gritty of it. But by the end of his life, the Mongol Empire occupied a substantial portion of Central Asia and China. And due to his exceptional military successes, Genghis Khan is considered one of the greatest conquerors of all time. Anthony Medera is with me. It is time for us to explore the world of Genghis Khan in about the year 1200 to 1227, when he supposedly died on August the 18th. And isn't this guy terrific?
That's incredible. Like you, Gareth, I really enjoyed the history of Attila the Hun. And there were rumors or some talk about possible links. Maybe they were born in similar areas when that vast area of Central Asia. But this guy was just phenomenal. I mean, he was just so much better, comparable to Alexander the Great, and really phenomenal.
Well, I found it fascinating to read about his conquests, but he started off life not particularly gloriously. He was in a poor tribe, although his father was a chief. He was married off at age 9 and sent to live with his erstwhile would-be wife's family, where he worked basically for them. And then eventually he was marriageable at around 12, and he got married to a woman called Borta. And it turns out that his father had been poisoned by these people called the Tatars. And that started the whole story for Genghis, because he went back to avenge his father's death, but he was a kid. He was like 12 years old. And he found his brothers and they rallied together, but the tribe actually cast their family out and they were in abject poverty. They had to live off of terrible things like bison carcasses and marmots, which are like gerbils. And that's what they had to eat. So his life was difficult when he was a kid.
First thing that was quite interesting was the approach that his father took to woo his wife to be. So his father was out on a raid. And that's what they did. And he saw this beautiful woman in a carriage being taken with this particular tribe. So he kidnapped her and made her his wife. So that's the way they operated in those days. And that was Genghis's mom. But yes, you're right. The dad said, look, you need to marry Borta. And the custom was he needed to go to Borta's family and look after them and work for them. But then his dad was poisoned. And so he was brought back to his clan. But interestingly enough, that kidnapping of Genghis's mom really set the scene for later battles, because that tribe, they really wanted revenge against his dad. And ultimately, when his dad was dead, they wanted revenge against any blood of his dad.
These tribal stories are quite hectic. I mean, he had an elder brother, but he was his half-brother called Bechter. And Bechter apparently wanted to exercise power and took Genghis's mother as a wife. And he didn't like this at all. So he and the other brothers ganged up and they killed him.
Yeah.
So he killed his own elder half-brother in order to establish his authority and save his mother from being taken as an extra wife. It's just very bizarre. Like, that time was so coarse and violent and complex.
After he had murdered his half-brother, he was kidnapped by another tribe, and he was put in what they call a wooden vase, so that's around your neck and then your hands, and then a rope tied to him. And
almost he had like to live stocks, right?
Exactly like that. And he had to live like that. And in the end, he had to work out how to escape. And one day he did. They used to have these big get-togethers around the fire, and everybody used to get drunk. And so he escaped. And there's so many times in his life, you see in his younger life, that he had to escape. And he used this tactic quite often. And he put himself in an ice-cold river and hid in the water so that they couldn't find him. It's absolutely frightening. But this is what brought them to the relationship with a very successful chief, which was Togrul. And he found the young Temujin in the river, and he basically dried him, looked after him, and sent him on his way back to his family. And he never forgot that. And the three of them really worked hard to sort of cement the growing Mongol Empire later on.
Yeah, I have to say that reading, and I found a brilliant book about him, which I had to skim through, because there's so many different tribal confederations and wars and, you know, tribes I'd never heard of before. I mentioned the Tatars, and there's an actual part of southern Russia, northern Mongolia called Tatarstan, which I didn't know about. These were a powerful tribe back in the late 1100s. And this guy went systematically through these tribes, just conquering them. He forayed into China, terrorized that part of the world. Apparently, the Chinese population was never as low as it was during the Mongol Empire. And it was largely as a result of famine and plagues and the flooding of the Yangtze River. But it was also because the Mongols would just execute hundreds of thousands of people every time that they opposed them in a war.
Well, he was a military genius. So amongst even being an administrator, but they were very much like, if you think back to our podcast on Attila, they were excellent horsemen. And their enemies were used to stand fighting, but these guys kept moving. So they could never really get them. I've said it so many times in our history podcast, is speed of attack. So Alexander used to pitch up. The guys hadn't even finished getting out of bed and Alexander would be on their doorstep. This was so similar with Genghis.
The other thing they used to do is they would feign a retreat and then they'd, you know, hide half the troops behind the trees or the hills. And then the enemy would think they were retreating and then they'd rout them and just take them out completely.
Yeah. And they used that particular tactic in the Yin Dynasty where they came up to Beijing and then they feigned a retreat and they left all their goods as if they just left the area and their alcohol. And then the people came out of the city sort of tucking into the food and alcohol. And then he made the turnaround and they came back and just flattened them.
It's worth mentioning at this point that the empire, and it started off tribal and then it grew into an empire, which was enormous, took up almost all of Asia by the end of it. But if you look at the lists of the greatest empires in world history, just in terms of the number of millions of kilometers squared, the British Empire, obviously, at its height in 1920, was 26.35% of the world. They controlled 35.5 million square kilometers. The second biggest empire that's ever existed in human history was the Mongol Empire.
Sure, that's incredible.
And that was 24 million kilometers squared and 17.8% of the world.
Sure, that's amazing. I think it took him up to about 38 years old to get the Mongol Empire together and sorted. And then he started going out to start conquering the greater Asia as such. And interestingly enough, whereas I suppose if you look at Alexander, he did everything in 10 years. So they were two different people, but just very successful.
This empire was very much based on meritocracy, which is interesting because at that stage in human history, most loyalties were along the lines of tribe and, you know, fealty and what you could do for me and what I could do for you. But Genghis Khan was an absolute meritocrat. If you were the smartest person in the village, then he would appoint you to be his advisor. If you were the best military tactician, he would put you into the army. If you were someone who was very good at sourcing food, he would make you the administrator for agriculture and that kind of thing. So he was a real stickler for merit. And perhaps that's also why his empire expanded as far as it did. He was hugely religiously tolerant too. He didn't mind what religion you had. He believed religion was a personal issue. He didn't force his own religion down on anyone, although he believed in the sky god, which was kind of a religion that all of his adherents and all of his tribes mostly took to. Later, Khans became Christians. He fought quite notably with the Shah of Persia at that stage. And he was Muslim, but he didn't have a problem with the religion.
I think what people have termed is a heroic monster because, I mean, he could be absolutely brutal. If you resisted him in any way, I mean, he'd line up every single person and slit their throats. But if you didn't, if you surrendered and if you were loyal to him, he was incredibly loyal back to you. And so there was so much to him than just a brutal killer. Very, very tactically astute, brilliant in psychological warfare. He used to create massive fear, just let the rumors go around on how scary they actually are. And then what people used to do, they'd rather go and kill themselves. Some of the women used to just go and jump off buildings because they didn't want to get conquered by the Mongols because they'd be raped and murdered. He created that psychological warfare. Interestingly enough, on the tactical side, he learned so much from the tribes and the regions that he conquered. And he brought that into his fold and he acquired those skills. So he was never scared to learn. And writing was a big part of his, if you can call it, administration. So he brought in a whole lot of different people to do that.
One of the things that he learned from the Chinese was siege warfare, and they made use of it at the Battle of Samarkand, where he defeated that city. Using siege warfare, they managed to conquer a place that up to then had not been conquered. But I do want us to pay attention to some of the ugly, vicious, spiteful, and nasty, brutal things that he and his army were well known for. He had a way of deciding who would live and who would die when he conquered nations, and it was called measuring against the linchpin. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't.
So apparently what they would do is they would line up all the male captives and they would walk beside a wagon wheel. It was a big wagon wheel. And if their heads were higher than the linchpin, which is a pin inserted at the end of the axle, they were immediately executed. So it was a huge wheel that they used to transport things on. And the technique used to preempt against revenge attacks that were common between the tribes at the time. So if you were tall and taller than the linchpin, tough luck for you. You were executed immediately. If you were short, they'd let you live because you were probably less dangerous.
Sure, that's amazing.
There was this guy called Jamukha who had been a friend of Genghis Khan and then turned against him. And Genghis Khan, I think very nobly, said to the guy, look, let's be friends again. He refused and wouldn't submit himself, said there could only be one sun in the sky. And so Genghis Khan said, fine, I'm going to have to kill you. And he said, please give me a noble death. And they would do this without spilling blood. They would break someone's back. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds like a pretty horrible way to die.
It is, but I think what the point was is there was no blood spilt. That's why it was honorable.
You're having your back broken.
And strangulation, Gareth, was another honorable way of dying.
Apparently, yeah. They also used to boil their opponent's generals alive.
Yeah, I don't think that was honorable.
There was one guy who was in charge of Iran. It was called the Khwarazmian Empire, and the Shah was a guy called Aladdin Muhammad, right?
Yes.
And he basically gave the middle finger to two envoys that Genghis Khan had sent, a Muslim and a Mongol. So instead of meeting with them and talking to them, the Shah had them shaved and then beheaded and sent their heads back. And Genghis Khan was furious. So he amassed 100,000 soldiers and headed for Iran. And this was not good news. When they eventually arrived there, they managed to find one of the Shah's top military leaders. They found him and they poured molten silver into his ears and his eyes to kill him.
Yeah, that's what they did. You see, so that those were the people that resisted Jeez. Him. So I think that was the last middle finger he ever showed to anybody.
Well, apparently that Shah died under mysterious circumstances on a small island in the empire. But the instruction had been given by Genghis Khan. He said, hunt this guy down. I'll give you 20,000 men and 2 years, but find this Shah and bring him to me. So he didn't take insults well.
No, he definitely didn't. But what was brilliant about Genghis Khan is that there was definitely succession planning in place. Some of his sons were brilliant, and they were doing a lot of the raiding and a lot of the battles that were fought later on. And also the grandsons, I think it's quite famous, is Kublai Khan, who was a significantly impressive conqueror himself, and he finally took over China that his grandfather hadn't managed to do. Whereas a lot of our heroes, when they passed away, there wasn't great succession. And that was so impressive about Genghis, is that I think the last descendant was finally disposed in 1920. So I think that's a very successful lineage from Genghis.
Well, it's worth mentioning here, you talk about succession. So he had three famous sons. The eldest one was Jockey, and Jockey might not have been his son, you know, because his wife had been abducted, and then he rescued her, Genghis Khan, this is. And when she came back, she was pregnant. So it may or may not have been his child, but he was, I suppose, good enough to adopt the child anyway. And Jockey was by far the eldest. But the problem was that his other sons refused to submit to Jockey. Now, the eldest of his other sons was called Chagatai. And Chagatai apparently had this really bad attitude. He was very aggressive and violent, not particularly calm and not very clever. The second son on that side, in other words, his third eldest son altogether, was called Ogedé. And they appointed him as the successor during Genghis Khan's life because he reckoned he was the most temperate, sensible, and moral of all of the children that he had. So he really did think it through. There's also some dispute over the fact that Jokhi might have been poisoned by Genghis Khan's orders because he died during his father's life and he'd become something of a political problem to him at that stage. So it is a complex story. And obviously, like any great empire, it's just never as good after the great conqueror themselves has died.
I'll agree with that. He was definitely impressive, but at least there was definitely some lineage. But what I really enjoyed about Genghis is he had so many different facets to him. Like I'd mentioned earlier, military genius and tactician, but also administratively, he was so, so good at taking the best out of the regions and the tribes that he conquered and just making the Mongol Empire so impressive and successful.
Well, it was exactly that. And they had a code. It was called the Yasa. And that was created by Genghis Khan. And they didn't really care about your ethnicity or your race. It was very much based along the lines of meritocracy, as I mentioned earlier. And the exception was Genghis Khan and his family, because obviously they were at the center of all of this. But there were Mongols and Turks and Muslims and Indians and Chinese and Europeans. There were all kinds of people who considered themselves to be part of the Mongol Empire. And he made tax exemptions for teachers and for monks and for scholars and doctors. And he didn't have this this vicious, you know, my way or the highway rule for everything. And he certainly was a military genius, but he was also an administrative genius, as you rightly point out. They also supposedly had quite a lot of legal equality for women in the Mongol Empire, which is interesting. There are supposedly roles that women played in politics in the Mongol Empire, and they would run things while Genghis was out on one of his conquests or raids. The wives would actually run and administer the empire, but they also didn't really have cities because they lived in these yurts, which are tents, and they would move as they needed to from place to place. They didn't really have one fixed abode. They were nomadic. He did eventually establish a capital near modern Ulaanbaatar. And we don't know where he's buried, right, Ant?
All we know is he fell off his horse. He was actually shot with arrows a few times in his life, but he could have been buried anywhere.
There are various stories about how exactly he died. You know, he was out hunting or he died because of a wound in his last campaign. There was also some kind of legend that a princess stabbed him with a small dagger. So we don't really know exactly what happened, but it's likely he just fell off his horse. He was already at an advanced age at that stage. But he asked to be buried long before that without markings. And just like Attila the Hun, I think these guys know that if they reveal the place of their burial, they're going to be disturbed. And he said, even if you have to turn rivers and make the rivers flow over my grave to hide my grave, you must do that. And they have discovered a permanent building which may have been a palace of Genghis Khan's. And they may be able to discover near that on the Oron River some sort of burial mound or situation or tomb or whatever it might be. Obviously, they're still busy doing investigations and archaeology in that area. But there is a Genghis Khan mausoleum, although that's not the place he's buried. It was constructed many years after his death, and it's a memorial. And it became something that the Chinese communists wanted to claim during their wars in 1939 and onward. So it's very much a matter of pride between Mongolia and China, who can claim the inheritance of Genghis Khan.
Yeah, China, definitely, that's part of the history. And they say he was fundamentally putting together the beginnings of China. Because he was such an incredible leader and such a massive person in history, I think quite a few people are trying to claim him as their patronage.
Well, Marco Polo was one of the people who I think was instrumental in helping Western historians figure out the story of Genghis Khan. And he does have this menacing reputation in parts of Iraq, Iran, and southern and Middle Eastern Asia, where he has a fearsome reputation for having made pyramids out of the beheaded corpses of people from cities in Central Asia that he conquered.
Yeah, so those are the ones that resisted. That's the middle finger problem.
So if you let him in, he was okay with you. Yeah. And he would subsume you into his army, into his empire. But if you resisted, he would take out every man, woman, and child.
Exactly, 100%. Jesus. But Gareth, if you can imagine the Caspian Sea and Baku, which is closer to Europe than to China, that was actually the birthplace sort of in that area of Stalin. And it's incredible that that's where they went. It's massive, massive, really the whole of Asia. And they say that the areas that he conquered was the size of Africa.
Wow, unreal.
It's incredible what he did.
In 2003, they did a groundbreaking historical genetics paper, which reported results that indicate that a substantial portion of men in the world are direct male line descendants of Genghis Khan. And that means they carry Y chromosomes, which came from an individual who lived almost 1,000 years ago. Now, what makes this amazing is that effectively, 1 in 200 men in the world today are direct male descendants of Genghis Khan. How do you like that?
That's amazing.
It's just amazing that there are that many people alive today who can claim that he is their great, 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 great grandfather. Blind History is brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. All the episodes are available on the cliffcentral.com website and app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Kublai Khan was a descendant of his. And there's a great poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge in which he says, "In Xanadu," another famous name, "in Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Elf the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea." And apparently, in Mongol culture, if you're a powerful man, you can have as many wives and concubines as you like. Cliffcentral.com.